America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It is the first hour of our Friday program. In the second hour, I've just some amazing economic news that or stories that I'd like to share with you. You know, what's the future of our economy? And throughout our second and third hours, anything goes Friday. Anything you want to talk about. We've got some science news stories, just a whole variety of stuff, and we'll be taking your calls. However, for our first hour, as always, Senator Bernie Sanders is with us, the independent from Vermont, neither a Republican nor a Democrat, the longest-serving member of the independent member of the House of Representatives, now in the United States Senate, the founder of the Progressive Caucus, and the man I think of as America's senator, Senator Bernie Sanders. Hey, Bernie, great to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
What's on your mind today? What's
It's a busy time in Washington. I'm in Burlington now, but it's been a busy week. Right now, the Senate is focusing on the energy bill, and people should watch it very closely, because if we get it right, and I'm not sure that we will, because there are a lot of powerful special interests who want us to get it wrong, but if we get it right, we can make a giant step forward in this country in lowering greenhouse gas emissions, reversing global warming, breaking our dependency on fossil fuel, becoming more energy independent, moving to sustainable energies like solar and wind. So we end in the process creating millions of good-paying jobs. So this is a very, very significant issue from an environmental perspective, global warming perspective, but also from an economic perspective. We can transform our energy system, create a lot of good-paying jobs, begin producing solar power in America, photovoltaics, manufacturing them in this country, manufacturing wind turbines, getting deeply involved in other sustainable energy technologies. So it is a very big deal, and people should pay attention to what's going on. We managed last week to get an amendment passed on which would create training programs for workers interested in green technologies. Right now, the truth of the matter is that if you're in a house and you want to make your own home more energy efficient, hard to find workers trained to do that, hard to find workers trained to put in photovoltaics or wind turbines. So we got a workforce development amendment passed, which I think will help us in that respect. Also want to provide funding for states, cities, and towns to help them work with local folks, citizens, homeowners, businesses, in terms of energy efficiency and sustainable energy. So a lot that's happening, people should pay attention to that.
Is part of this moving the $10, $12, $15 billion in welfare we've been giving the oil and gas and coal companies over to things like block grants for cities and local communities?
Absolutely.
To do this kind of,
absolutely.
Is that the essence of it?
That's absolutely correct. And one of the issues that will be coming up next week is this whole issue of how we incentivize the American people to move toward energy-efficient cars, hybrids, plug-in hybrids, electric cars. And I think that instead of giving the huge tax breaks that Bush and his friends want to give to millionaires and billionaires, we should be generous in tax credits and other incentives so that if a middle-class or working-class person wants to buy a hybrid, let's help them do that, because that's a win-win situation.
And help Detroit as well.
Well, we got to sit down with Detroit. Is very troublesome in this whole issue. They have been dragging very far behind the Japanese in terms of coming up with energy-efficient cars. They have fought vigorously, although they're giving a little bit now in terms of CAFE standards. As you know, we're driving vehicles in this country today that get worse mileage per gallon, was the case 20 years ago, which is just absolutely beyond comprehension given the technology out there.
Well, and the average gas mileage in Europe is like 43 miles
absolutely
per gallon.
China is moving forward. Japan has moved forward. I was in a retrofitted Toyota Prius last month. It gets 150 miles per gallon. So, yeah, you know, these cars are out there. The technology is out there. But Detroit makes its money by producing heavy, energy, inefficient type of automobile. So we've got to work with them on that.
Bernie, I'm really curious about that. Why Why do they do that? It whacked them in the 70s. You know, the Japanese companies came and just ate their lunch when the oil crisis happened in the early 70s. They were not ready for it. They should have seen it coming this time. It's almost like if we were running, you know, if the government was making the policy, the industry would be working better.
Tom, I honestly don't know the answer. And I'll tell you, I often warn the listeners, as you have heard me over the years, not to get paranoid. You know, we get calls from people who are a little bit out in paranoia land. But here's my paranoia. You want to hear my paranoia on this
issue?
Sure.
Yeah.
What we know is that in the last number of years, the auto industry has laid off hundreds of thousands of workers. A couple of weeks ago, Senator Debbie Stabenow of Michigan had a very good meeting, a public meeting, where she brought the heads of Ford, Chrysler, and GM to Washington, and many of us had an opportunity to talk to them and so forth. My concern is these guys are moving big time to China. They want the parts to be built in China. They are now getting into alliances with Chinese companies to produce cars, presumably now for the Chinese market. But I fear very much that some of those products may end up coming back into the United States in years to come. My paranoia here, and I'm not sure that I'm right at all, is that under the guise of opposing these just quote-unquote terribly onerous environmental standards pushed by Congress, they're going to have to move more and more to China. So I think it may be an excuse. I don't know. But it is inexplicable from an objective perspective. They are losing billions and billions of dollars every single year producing cars that the American people increasingly don't want.
Yeah, I'm baffled. They did this with Mexico. I mean, that was Michael Moore's first movie. You know, Roger and Me was shutting down five factories in Flint.
Well, they're shutting down big time. Not only the plants, but the parts, which is a very big part of the automobile economy. But General Motors is apparently telling suppliers that if they want to supply parts to GM, as Walmart has done as well, they better produce them in China.
The one thing that I've heard is that the more steel there is in a car, the physically larger the car is, the higher the price is. And the higher the price is, because profit is, you know, generally a percentage of the price, the more gross money, the more gross dollars they make on it, even, you know, at the same percentage of profit. And so they've decided to go for the larger cars because they can sell fewer cars and make a higher profit.
That is what I believe is the case. In any case, so we got to work with them. We got to help the American people buy energy efficient cars. We have, for example, there's another area out there where the most gains to be made most quickly are energy efficiency. There is some estimates out there that if people retrofitted their homes on average, they can cut their fuel consumption by 40% and save a whole lot of money. So the question is, but that takes some money to do. So we should be providing tax credits and other incentives to say to you, you know what? We want you to weatherize your home. We want to make your home energy efficient. We want you to put in solar hot water heaters at the very least, maybe solar paneling, and we're going to help you do that. So that's and then in terms of purchasing wind turbines, small wind turbines, which will be primarily used in rural areas, are becoming less and less expensive. And we have to help people be able to purchase those as well. And if we can produce these wind turbines in the United States, produce the photovoltaic units, we're going to create jobs in production, we're going to create jobs in installation, we're going to save energy. It is a win-win-win situation. And we've been working with the Apollo project, that is a group of both environmentalist and trade union organizations, to push this concept forward. So that's a whole area out there where we have tremendous potential. Needless to say, the opposition coming from big oil, comes from big coal, comes from Detroit automobile manufacturers. But I hope that we can make the kinds of changes that we want. We're hung up right now. Senator Bingaman of New Mexico has introduced legislation. I would go further, but it is a step forward, which says that 15% of the electricity produced by utilities should be from sustainable energy. And that would be a significant increase. Some of us want to go to 20%, but it would be a step forward. Republicans are opposing that. Now, there's another issue that's coming up that we just learned is coming up yesterday, again, and that is, of course, the immigration issue, a very contentious issue. Most of the discussion has been with regard to the path toward legalization, and there's a lot of hot rhetoric about that and so forth and so on. I believe there should be a path to legalization. I think that's basically all that you can do with 12 million people in this country. No one is going to send them back over the border and so forth and so on. I think you need to strengthen our borders. We need to hold employers accountable. But the untold story on this discussion is the guest worker program, which I very strongly oppose. That's an effort on the part of corporate America to lower wages in America. We've got to watch that very, very closely.
Yeah, it's the new Bracero program.
Yeah,
that's exactly what it is.
But it's expansion. It's beyond agriculture.
Yeah. Because the Bracero program is mostly agriculture. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment, 866-303-2270. Bernie Sanders will be taking your calls in just a moment, 16 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Oh, no, 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 no. We're bringing the dream back. The dream of America's... I know it seemed to go away when Ronald Reagan came into power in 81. And the cons have been bashing the dream of America for 26 years. But it is coming back. 21 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program. Our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. And Bernie, our phones are slammed. Before we take the first call, though, I just have to play a 20-second sound clip for you from Jimmy Carter on July 15th, 1979, if you don't mind.
Sure.
May I?
Moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
Can you imagine if Reagan had not come into office and his legislation had stayed law, then we never 9/11 wouldn't have happened. We wouldn't be in Iraq. I mean, it's mind-boggling.
No, I'm glad you're focusing on that. The potential for solar, the potential for wind and other sustainable energies is incredible. Not only again in reversing global warming, but in creating jobs.
Yeah, well said. Alan in Beverly Hills, California, you are on the line with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Oh, okay. Hi. Two quick questions, real quick. If this great energy bill is passed, which I agree with, by the House and the Senate, will Bush sign the bill? And two, what kind of crimes does a president and vice president have to commit for the House to impeach, the Senate to try, and eventually the Justice Department try, convict, and hang them both?
Okay, first of all, I did not say it was a quote-unquote great energy bill. I said it has some promise. We have tremendous opposition from Republicans, from big money interests, from the president. We're going to try to make it as good an energy bill as it can be, but certainly listening to President Carter in 1979, this bill will not go where Carter wanted to go in 1979. So it's not a great bill, but it's a step forward. In terms of impeachment, to my mind, what the American people, what the ordinary person wants is for us to move this country in a very, very different direction. Probably the loudest proponent was somebody who would be most favorably proposed to an impeachment situation dragging on for years would be Karl Rove, who can then shift the political balance and say, see, that's what happens. Democrats are in power by a little bit. They have overreached. They're trying to remove government. So I think what we have got to do is go it the old-fashioned way, and that is through grassroots organizing, through education, make sure that we have a stronger Congress in 2008, and hopefully we have a progressive president during that time. That's what my focus is on right now.
It's about us. It's about the parade. It's not about the leaders, because we are the ones who push the leaders.
Bush is the worst president in the modern history of this country. Will go down in history, in my view, as one of the worst that we have ever had. Our job is to turn this country around, not get hung up on an impeachment process, which, in fact, will turn off millions of American people and give Republicans an opportunity to turn defeat into victory. That's my view.
Yeah. Charlie in Brooklyn, New York, you're on the air with Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, thanks. It seems to me the Republicans, the right-wingers, have seized upon the public's dissatisfaction with the situation in Iraq, and one of the charges they're bandying about now is that this is a do-nothing Congress. And one of the things they're pointing to is the promises of ethics reform, that lobbyists would have to wait 2 years congressmen would have to wait 2 years before they could become lobbyists again. And there were specific charges about family members of politicians being on their payroll. Bernie, I wish you'd give an honest evaluation of where ethics reform is and what we can really expect this term.
Well, I think, in fairness, both in the House and the Senate, significant steps have been made in going forward in terms of ethics reform. But I want to say that I think that campaign finance reform is ultimately far, far, far more important than so-called ethics reform, as important as that is. I mean, right now, what ethics reform says now, that if some lobbyist, I don't do this anyhow, but would it take me out for lunch for $30? My goodness, he couldn't do that anymore. Not going to buy my vote for $30. Well, that's not really the way it works. The way it really works right now in the energy bill is take a look at the zillions of dollars that oil companies, coal companies, other energy companies have put into the political process. Look at what the pharmaceutical industry has done. Spent almost $1 billion in lobbying in the last 10 years. That's really where the action is. I think the Democrats have made a significant step forward. What the Republicans are trying to do, certainly in the Senate, where it takes 60 votes to get cloture, to move forward, what they are doing is resisting almost everything, and then they come back and say, well, Democrats can't do anything. In fact, the Democrats have accomplished some things, not as much as I want. I think there's some fault to be placed on the shoulders of Democratic leadership as well. But what the Republican goal is to prevent anything significant from happening and then say, see, these guys can't do anything. But in ethics, I think we are making a significant step forward.
But the biggest step would be public financing.
Absolutely. No, the yeah, real issue, look, just stop and think. How does it happen that these guys give hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks to the wealthiest 1%, and it took us 10 years to raise the minimum wage to 7.25? Why is that?
Yeah, and it's not because the majority of the Americans want it that way.
Overwhelmingly, the American people want to raise the minimum wage.
Yep.
And we have, by the way, accomplished that finally.
Yeah, finally. Senator Bernie Sanders with us 27 minutes past the hour. Back with your calls in just a moment.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Tom Hartman here with you. Hey, by the way, head over to airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page. Or go to airamerica.com and click on the link that says Tom Hartman Program. And you can join our blog and start blogging. That would put you in the running for our daily giveaway at the end of the show today. David Poole, our producer, in his own inimitable and totally whimsical fashion, will pick the best comment of the day from our airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page blog. Be a serious comment, a funny one, although all the folks from yesterday saying, David, I want to have your baby. Sorry, sucking up to David just doesn't work. That doesn't work. So anyhow, that person's going to receive, whoever has the best comment of the day is going to receive an autographed copy of my newest book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, that just came out in paperback. Blog with us over at airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page for your chance for that. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Tom in Washington, D.C., you're live with Senator Sanders.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Senator Sanders. Nice to talk to both of you. I just have a quick question for Mr. Sanders in regards to Bush's national continuity plan. I don't understand how individuals in the country, as well as the Congress, aren't more up in arms about an individual taking control of the government, ensuring the constitutionality of it, as he has been quoted as saying, it's just a darn piece of paper. And he has total disdain for Congress. So how are we supposed to react to a disaster?
Well, as I indicated a moment ago, Tom, I think we have a president who will go down in history as certainly one of our worst, who has done incredible damage to our environment in terms of foreign policy, to our standings in the world, has given huge tax breaks to people who don't need it and cut back on programs for people who do need the help. And certainly one of the areas where he has been a disaster has been respect for our Constitution and our civil liberties. I think what you are finding right now is both in the House Judiciary Committee and in the Senate Judiciary Committees a number of investigations and work regarding the habeas corpus issue in terms of what Bush and Gonzalez did with regard to the U.S. attorney issue, and many other issues. So I think you are going to see work being done on restoring some of the undoing some of the damage that Bush did to our Constitution.
And do you think that this presidential directive number 51 that says that in case of an emergency anywhere in the world that affects the U.S. even economically, that he will take supervision of the legislative branch, is there going to be pushback from Congress on that?
I will be very surprised. I certainly, it goes without saying, that's one of the many issues, obviously, that Congress has got to pay a lot of attention to.
Okay. Chick in Dover, Delaware. You're on the line with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Tom, you mentioned that in Europe they have 43 miles of the gallon. In my search for a fuel-efficient car a couple weeks ago, I went to the EPA site, and there's only two cars offered in the United States to get in that range, and that one would be the Toyota Prius at 60 in the city and 40 in the highway, and the Toyota Civic Hybrid that gets 49 in the city and 51 on the highway. Apples for apples, oranges for oranges, the Toyotas and Chevys and the Fords and all were getting in the highest that they offered, like the Chevy Cobalt was 34. I found that it didn't really make a whole lot of difference whether it was a foreign car or an American-made car. They're all offering that mid-30 as their top line, except for the two hybrids. What kind of cars are they offering in Europe that gets that?
Well, my understanding, Tom, you jump in, but my understanding is that the same companies are making cars that get a lot better mileage per gallon in Europe than they are in the United States.
Yeah, they do, and it's basically that they're just lighter cars. They're just as safe. I mean, I lived in Germany for a year, and you could drive 120 miles an hour on the Autobahn, and there would be, from time to time, 60-car pileups, and everybody would walk away from them. I mean, the cage of the car is very, very safe, but they're just not these giant, hulky things. It's they tend not to be anywhere near as large. We're looking at average fuel efficiency, and they've got a lot of little, tiny cars in Europe, and there's just not a lot of little, tiny cars being sold in the United States yet, but... Yeah, that's.
But also, Glenn, there is, you know, the Union of Concerned Scientists came out with a report which said that using off-the-shelf technology, that is not having to, you know, create new inventions, you can substantially increase energy efficiency in cars that are on the road right now.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Glenn in Prineville, Oregon, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi. Glad to talk to you. The problem I see with our energy policy is that we keep doing the same thing over and over, and I keep worrying about we bail auto industry out of problems, Chrysler, whoever, we bail them out of problems, and they just continue doing the same old thing. Why don't we invest our money into mass transportation and get away from the hegemony that we have right now, which is just totally crazy, where we have to go attack other countries to take their oil from them?
Well, Glenn, that's a very good point. And I think there is no question that compared to Europe, compared to Japan, even China, in many ways our rail system is far behind where other countries are in terms of rural transportation systems. In the state of Vermont, very serious problems in our rural areas in terms of decent bus service as well. So your point is well taken. I think we should be spending the kinds of money that we need and creating the kind of jobs that can be created, rebuilding our rail system to create a modern, efficient rail system around the country, improve the subways in large cities and public transportation in rural areas throughout the country. Your point is well taken.
Yeah, and the remnants of it are out there. I mean, when we lived in Vermont, the 10 years that we lived in Vermont, you find all these little old train stations that, you know, aren't being used as train stations anymore.
Well, you know that story, Tom, about what General Motors did, I think it was, when was it, after World War II?
After World War I in Los Angeles, with Goodyear, they bought up, they privatized the rail system there.
Right, it wasn't only Los Angeles, it was other parts of the country as well.
Yeah, interesting, yeah. J.R. in Vancouver, Washington, you're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Okay. Yeah,
J.R.?
Tom,
you're on the air.
Yeah, I have a question for Mr. Sanders. My question is about the direction that the Republican Party has gone versus their stance prior to when they were in power. They used to continuously say that Democrats were obstructionists, and they would claim when they wouldn't get cloture, but now they're actually acting as they claim Democrats were.
Yes. Well, I mean, their strategy is not difficult to understand. The Republican Party really stands for very, very little right now. There's a limit to how many hundreds of billions of dollars you can give to the richest 1%. They are distancing themselves from the president on Iraq as that policy looks increasingly disastrous to the American people. Homophobia will only get you so far. Sexism will only get you so far. There's not a whole lot that they can say. So their strategy right now is essentially to try to put as many roadblocks as they can into good legislation. It took us much too long to pass the minimum wage. As I mentioned a moment ago, there are strong objections on the Republican party for serious energy reform legislation to break out dependency on fossil fuel, and on it goes. So that is their strategy, basically, to try to obstruct as much as they can and then say, look, these guys haven't accomplished much.
Yeah. Rowdy in Little Rock, Arkansas, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hey, good to talk to you, Senator. I wanted to expand on your comment about the automakers moving manufacturing processes to China. I think it's going to become a national defense issue when we are unable to manufacture anything in this country. And the day is not that far away when it's going to happen. We're not going to be able to make shoes, clothes, pants, or anything that, you know, that's how we won World War II, is all our factories switched over to military production. And when we don't when the last person in this country dies that knew how to make a pair of shoes, we are going to be defenseless as a nation. And
you know what?
That's how our enemies are going to take us over, because we're going to be helpless.
Riley, the point you are making is an excellent and very important point. We have lost in the last 6 years since Bush has been president, and we were losing before that as well. We've lost 3 million good-paying manufacturing jobs. In my own small state of Vermont, we've lost about 25% of our manufacturing jobs since Bush has been in office alone. And the point that you make is cannot be overstated, and that is that if we are not producing what we need as a nation, if we're simply purchasing our products from China and elsewhere, it is hard for me to imagine how we can be the kind of nation that we want to be. Case in point, I just talked to a high-ranking military official. We've been hearing concerns, and I think many of the listeners know this. A lot of our soldiers in Iraq now who are trying to defuse and destroy these IEDs don't have the kinds of vehicles that they need to protect them if these IEDs go off. Do you know, Tom, where the best vehicle is now being made, of which we do not have enough right now? Do you know where it's being made?
It's being made
in South Africa.
Oh, no.
It's being made in South Africa in a production facility which isn't producing them fast enough. So our soldiers are being placed in harm's way. We can't make it in the United States of America.
Why aren't they making them in Detroit? I mean, why can't General Motors get a contract?
Radical idea. This is what Rowdy was saying. This is what your caller was just saying. The hope now is, by the way, that they are going to be transferring production and trying to gear up production here in the United States. But here's a case in point of what your caller just said. Our soldiers are dying because they don't have the kind of armored vehicles to go to withstand these IEDs. The most successful, the best product we have now comes from South Africa. They're not producing enough there. We're not producing them in America.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredibly strange. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's our brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders, the independent from Vermont, on taking your calls at 866-303-2270. The Tom Hartman radio program here on Air America Radio. You can drop into our live chat room. Go over to airamerica.com. Click through to the Tom Hartman program. Or you can go to tomhartman.com, either one. You can click on the live chat room, drop in and say hi. And also our blog at airamerica.com. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Four days, 12 hours, 4 minutes, 40 seconds until George W. Bush voluntarily leaves office. 792 years ago this day in history, the writ of habeas corpus was signed in the field of Runnymede in northern England by King John. So interesting numbers for the day. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, and Kim in San Francisco.
Do an advertisement for myself, if I could.
Please.
We have a very good website, which we update daily. It's sanders.senate.gov. And I think it gives people a pretty good insight into some of what's going on in the Senate. So people should feel free to visit us. We'd love to have them there.
Great. Sanders.senate.gov. And thanks for sensitizing me to that, Bernie. I'll start mentioning it every week.
Thank you.
And we'll put a link to it on our homepage. Kim in San Francisco, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. Bernie, yours is the only political contribution, although albeit a tiny contribution, that I've ever felt completely good about. Let me say I want to thank you for your amendments to the amnesty bill. That thing needs a whole lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
And the most important thing I want to ask you is what is your philosophy for keeping up the good fight for all these years? Because, you know, I'm just an ordinary person, and there are times that I absolutely throw my hands up in the air and think, I'm going to watch MTV or something.
Well, here, Kim, first of all, thank you very much for your support. I have four kids and, as of now, three grandchildren. And, you know, I think we just have the moral obligation to make sure that the world that we leave to those kids, those young people, is a better world than the one that we inherited. That's number one. Number two, I have the opportunity to get around the great state of Vermont, and I see thousands of kids in schools and workers and senior citizens and veterans. And you know what? And I don't think Vermont is all that different from the rest of the country. So many good people out there, so many decent people out there who want to see our country improved. And then you go to Washington and you see the power of big money and the greed of all these large multinational corporations who represent a small minority of the American people, but get their way. So when I look at all of that, it seems to me that the right thing to do and the thing that I feel good about is to keep fighting. And I think, as Tom Hartman often says, despair is not an option. When that happens, then the Karl Roves and the Dick Cheneys and the George Bushes benefit. That's what they want. So we got to keep fighting. We are in the majority. The values that we hold are the values, in my view, of the vast majority of the people.
And that's a phrase that I stole from you 3.5 years ago.
That was a damn good phrase, I have to tell you.
No wonder it sounds so good to you. Dave in San Mateo, California, you're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, and I would like to thank you for all the work you do for all of us non-investor class people across the country. Hey, Senator Sanders, I just wanted to ask a quick question. We're coming up with another round of funding for the quote-unquote emergency funding for the war and occupation in Iraq. Why don't the Democrats tie any emergency funding to a rollback, equal rollback in the tax cuts, so that we can pay for this thing and start putting a little pinch on the people at the top of the food chain instead of all of us at the bottom?
That's a very good point. One of the particular outrages, of the many outrages that this president has committed, is he said, this war is painless. Don't worry about it. It's $500 billion, not a problem. We can pay for that. And by the way, we can give huge tax breaks to the wealthiest people in this country. I think Dave is suggesting that if we asked our wealthiest 1% who receive huge tax breaks to pay for this war, maybe there might be more opposition to the war. I think he has a good point. But the bottom line is we've got to use every tactic that we can to end this war as soon as we possibly can, bring our troops home, and then wage an intelligent effort, which is going to require a lot more than military hardware, to rally the American people against the kind of terrorism that we're seeing around the world.
Dave in Los Angeles, California, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Bernie, an honor. I just got a quick suggestion. I love to hear you talk about energy efficiencies and mass transportation. I'd like to roll that all up together. I think I have an idea that would align environmentalists, business people, alternative energy people, is use the federal highway funds. They've been used for alcohol consumption and speed limits before, to modify the behavior of states to put a priority on the efficiency of the infrastructure. Millions of gallons are being wasted in traffic jams and pollutants being dumped into the air just out of the inefficiency of our infrastructure. and this would be an investment, like Tom says. Business people would love this. They would love to have a more efficient transportation system. Environmentalists, less air pollution, but I'd like to see that prioritized.
Very good point, Dave. Thank you.
Interesting. Fritz in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. You're live with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I don't have so much a question. Well, it is a question as to where I could get results or if there is any poll leading to why there is only a 23% approval rating of Congress right now.
Yeah.
Well, I think the answer is, you know, people are disgusted with the White House. They want the Congress to begin to address the concerns that they face, the crisis in health care, bringing our troops home from Iraq, the environment. I think the growing gap between the rich and the poor, disastrous trade policies, and for a variety of reasons, some being Republican obstructionism, some being, in my view, incorrect priorities on the part of the leadership right now in Congress, it's not happening. I think at the end of the day, what we have accomplished is defeating right-wing extremism. That's good. But I don't think that the Democrats have yet come up with that agenda that the average American says, thank God, go for it. And I think that that has a lot to do with standing up for the middle class, taking on the big money interest. And if Bush wants to veto, let him, give him his veto pen. Let him veto it.
Yeah.
Let
the well, I think also one of the reasons why people are so upset with Congress is because they passed the supplemental to give Bush more money for the war that you voted against.
Yes. I think that's part of it.
I think that's probably the biggest part of it, and the media in the country just won't even talk about it. Senator Sanders, thanks. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom. Take care.
57 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Welcome to the Democracy Zone.
Anything Goes Friday here. Tom Hartman with you. We'll be taking your calls at 866-303-2270. Blogging over at airamerica.com. And, of course, passing along a copy, a signed, autographed, personalized copy of Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. My newest book out in paperback in David's opinion, the best blog entry for the day over at airamerica.com. And you're welcome to drop in our live chat room, too, where I hang out during the breaks. Before I get to your calls, before we just, you know, kind of get into the day, there's a couple of things that I wanted to share with you here. Just you know, point of privilege, I guess, that I think are really important and really vital news that I'm not seeing on, like, all the progressive news sites and all this. It's not that you're not going to find this in the normal routine news channels, and therefore I think it's really important. It's worth mentioning. First of all, yesterday afternoon, the Bush administration announced that they are going to politely decline the offer from Vladimir Putin to put our so-called U.S. missile defense system in one of the former Soviet republics rather than in Poland or you know, that's what they're talking about now. And there hasn't been a response, an official response from Russia. You know, I mean, Putin before had said if we went ahead and did this, he was going to point his nuclear missiles at Europe. Well, I think the official response has happened. This from Pravda. Russia has successfully tested a new missile, the R-500, the capacity of which allows it to destroy any defense system, including most recent prospective ballistic missile defense systems. R-500 tests are to be finished in 2008, whereas in 2009 these missiles will be used to equip the Iskander tactical missile systems. In other words, they're saying, you want an arms race? We'll give you an arms race. You want a missile defense system? We'll see your missile defense system and raise you an offensive missile system. And who wins in all this? The big corporations that are selling this stuff to you know, and lobbying the Republicans and many of the Democrats in Congress. So that, number one. Number two, the whole Scooter Libby thing, there's a subtext to this, and not just the Scooter Libby part of it, the Karl Rove part of it, the subpoenas, the Harriet Myers, the Sarah Taylor, all this stuff. The subtext to it all is this idea of presidential privilege, of executive privilege. And I want to thank Tony. I don't know if he wants his last name mentioned on the air, so I'm not going to. But an attorney who sent me an email that got me digging into the Constitution, and I just find this fascinating. He points out that in the Constitution, Article 1 is about what the founders thought was the most important branch, you know, the first among equals, the closest to the people, that is Congress, the House and Senate. Article 1 defines how the House and Senate is organized. Article 2 of the Constitution is about the executive branch, the presidency. And Article 3 is about the judicial branch, the judiciary. And interestingly, in Article 1, there is a very clear statement of what you would call privilege. And this is from Section 6 of Article 1 of the Constitution, talking about the House and Senate. The senators and representatives shall receive a compensation for their services to be ascertained by law and paid out by the Treasury. They shall, in all cases except treason, felony, and breach of the peace, be privileged from arrest during their attendance at the session of their respective houses, and in going to and returning from the same, and for any speech or debate in either house, they shall not be questioned in any other place. Now, this is the basis of privilege for members of the House and Senate. In other words, they can't, because they're closest to the people, they have something like executive privilege. But as Tony, this attorney who sent me this note, pointed out, in Article 2, there is no such language. There's nothing in Article 2 that says that the president has a similar privilege. In fact, it says the opposite. Section 3 of Article 2, the part that defines the executive branch, says the president shall from time to time give to the Congress information of the State of the Union and recommend to their consideration such measures as he may judge necessary and expedient. He shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed and shall commission all the officers of the United States. That's Section 3 of Article 2. In other words, the president is like, you know, he's got a job to do, but he's being held accountable. His job is to do what Congress tells him to do. I mean, if you want to say, you know, Bush keeps saying, my job is to, you know, protect the American people. My job is to, well, actually, your job is to faithfully execute the laws, and Congress makes the laws. So your job is to do what Congress tells you to do. And Tony says, one can argue, as I believe, that privacy, he goes on to talk about privacy as well, is a type of right envisioned by the framers of the Ninth Amendment, which provides the enumeration of the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage any others retained by the people. He says, this clearly states that the people retain rights other than those spelled out in the Constitution. In contrast, there's no constitutional provision from which it can be inferred that the president has unspecified rights or privileges. In other words, the Ninth Amendment doesn't say, the president holds additional powers. So he says the claim of executive privilege has been created out of thin air. And in fact, it was. It was created out of thin air by a Supreme Court decision some years ago. And I don't recall the specific decision. I'm sure I'll hear from one of many of our listeners about it. We've got some really smart folks. But he points out, he says, I find this really odd that conservatives, in quotes, want strict constructionists who are not going to legislate from the bench. And yet it was the judiciary system that created this idea of executive privilege for the president, which does not exist in the Constitution. It only exists in the Constitution for the House of Representatives and the Senate. But Bush is going to claim executive privilege. He's going to say that he can operate in the dark. He can close the doors and pull the curtains, and no problem. So those, you know, just a couple of things that, and then finally, just in the next 3 minutes, and then we'll take a break and we'll just take your calls for the next 2 hours. I want to share with you just a series of interesting stories, just a sentence or two from each, and let you draw your own conclusions from this, you know, from what this may be. First, from today's Wall Street Journal. Headline, home foreclosures hit fresh high. A record number of homeowners entered the foreclosure process during the first quarter, topping the previous high set in the final quarter of 2006. Ohio, Michigan, Indiana, California, Florida, Nevada, Arizona weighed down the broader numbers and foreclosure numbers. Job losses in the Midwest have pushed up foreclosures there, and the housing market has quickly deteriorated in four other states. Okay, that from the Wall Street Journal. This from the Financial Times of England. The headline, subprime turmoil takes toll on banks. Subprime loans, these are loans for mortgages to people who are not super creditworthy. Turmoil in the U.S. mortgages market took a toll on earnings of Goldman Sachs, Bear Stearns, and Freddie Mac amid suggestions that Wall Street's long run of record-breaking profits may be coming to an end. Yesterday's report suggested the party on Wall Street is quieting at several banks. Goldman's revenue dropped 24% to $3.37 billion, partly as a result of problems in the mortgage market. While rising defaults have not spread into the Alt-A sector, where borrowers have higher credit scores, volumes of new Alt-A mortgages are also down. Okay, that from the Financial Times. Here's another one from the Financial Times. This headline, markets could take U.S. deficit rise, says Stud. Now just notice the thread here. The Wall Street Journal, the economy is taking a hit because of, you know, as interest rates go up and there's more foreclosures, and not just interest rates going up. Also, as middle-class incomes are being wiped out, manufacturing incomes are being wiped out, more and more people can't make their mortgage payments. And then the Financial Times pointed out that banks are now starting to lose money as a result of this. And then another article in the Financial Times saying that this an analysis done by McKinsey Global Institute found that global capital markets, in other words, how are we going to deal with this fact that we're becoming more and more broke as a nation? Global capital markets would be able to finance a near doubling of the U.S. current account deficit to $1.6 trillion a year by 2012. McKinsey estimates that based on current trend growth rates and current exchange rates, the U.S. deficit will reach $1.6 trillion, or 9% of gross domestic product, in 5 years' time. This is the disastrous course that Ronald Reagan set us on and that George W. Bush has been following. They point out that the U.S. will soak up 77% of the total available pool of surplus capital in the entire world. And by soaking it up, it means we're borrowing it, which means that we have to pay it back or we have to give away our country. They point out again in this article in the Financial Times, by 2012, the U.S. would have an external debt GDP ratio of 46%, roughly similar to that of Mexico today. That is what Reaganomics has brought us. And then here, to finally wrap this up, two real quick pieces. One from the New York Times. Concerned that their personal finances might become a political liability once again, Bill and Hillary Rodham Clinton in April sold millions of dollars worth of stock. They converted their stock into cash. Maybe we all should be. And then finally in the Financial Times, an article headlined, Democrats Seek New Way Beyond Clintonomics. Yeah. Good plan. They're talking about no more free trade. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now, heaven knows.
Listener-supported radio, the Tom Hartman Program, supported by you, our listeners, letting your local radio station know that you are listening, letting your advertisers, in particular the advertisers to your local radio station, know that you're listening and that you will support their products and recommend their products. And thanks also for patronizing our national sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee, sacredgroundscoffee.com, Small Dog Electronics, smalldog.com, the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, and Purina One Natural Blends, 1-866-380-MEOW. So one final point. This is so important that what we've seen over the last 26 years is the systematic dismantling of the infrastructure and the true and core nature of the United States. And it's being done for a very specific purpose. It's being done to cripple the middle class, to stop them from being politically active. I mean, the conservatives in the 60s and 70s looked at the middle class rising up, and groups all the way from students to women to African Americans to gays saying, hey, wait a minute, we want some power in the society. And they felt that they had the power to speak out because they had some economic backstopping. And the conservatives looked at that and said, this is terrible. You know, Detroit's in flames. You know, look at Watts. I mean, we can't have this. This is terrible. We have to disempower the middle class. And they were pretty open about it, by the way, in their own correspondences. And so they did. So that's where we are now. And so how do we fix that? I find it particularly interesting that you get these guys like Thomas Friedman running around going, the world is flat. The world is flat. Everything is, you know, everything. Everybody should be competing with 6 billion other workers. Well, in India, which everybody's holding up as this great icon of, you know, look at how wonderful it's. India's just, you know, they're booming. And they are. Because all our jobs are going there. In India, it is against the law to run a chain store. It is against the law for a foreign corporation to come into India and operate a retail store. Walmart is barred by law from India. This from today's Financial Times. India's retail sector generated about 12 trillion 800 billion rupees. That's $312 billion U.S. in sales last year and accounted for 40% of the gross domestic product. This is their retail stores. So 40% of the entire nation's economic activities coming from retail sales. You got that? But analysts estimate corporations control only 3% of the retail market in India. 97% of the retail market in India is owned by small families who have little shops. 97%. Of the sector that is the full 40% of the entire economy of India. And, of course, the globalists are over there going, oh, we can't have this. We got to get Walmart in here. It'll be more efficient after all. It's crazy. But I just want to point out that these guys who say the world is flat and America should just throw open the doors and we should do away with tariffs and we shouldn't protect our domestic industries and we shouldn't protect our workers and we shouldn't protect small business people and we shouldn't protect entrepreneurs because after all, India has opened their doors to us. Well, they've opened their doors to us moving our jobs there. But when we tried to put Walmart in there, they told us where we could put it. Dan in San Diego, California. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Yeah, morning. I had hoped to talk to Senator Sanders, but anyway, I'll tell you.
For me.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
He talked about organizing the grassroots as part of the strategy for winning the elections, and I think that's the wrong strategy. It's part of the reasons why Democrats have continually lost ground until things have gotten so bad that even some of the dumbed-down faction has seen the light. I mean, you're going up against an organized echo-spin smear machine, radical.
No, but wait a minute. In the 60s and 70s, the Republicans built a grassroots machine. I mean, literally, build a grassroots machine from the ground up, using principally the churches. But you know, they built this huge grassroots movement, and it took them into power, even though their cranky, you know, philosophy represents the minority of America. The Democrats hadn't been. They had been increasingly through the 70s and 80s and 90s taking more and more money from lobbyists and ignoring their grassroots machine. And Howard Dean's just been putting it back together in the last couple of years. I think it's working.
Yeah, but the difference is back then the Republicans weren't going up an echo spin smear machine, a complicit media, and that's what the Democrats are going up against right now.
But if you don't do it from the grassroots, what do you have left, Dan?
If what?
If you don't do it from the grassroots.
They have to start fighting back, and they need to stop being, trying to be bipartisan and taking the high road and preaching to the choir.
Oh, I agree with all that. I agree with all that. But if they don't, if the Democratic Party... Yeah, but I agree. But if the Democratic Party doesn't build a strong grassroots organization the way Howard Dean is trying to do and the way that Rahm Emanuel and DLC Dems, frankly, don't want because they'll lose power. But if the Democratic Party doesn't build a strong grassroots organization, they're toast. They're gonna vanish in 10 years and be replaced by the Greens or something like that.
Yeah, but they at least have to tell people, you know, show them what the other side is doing that's not in their best interest, and they haven't been doing that.
On that point, I absolutely agree with you. The Democrats need to get a spine. They need to be speaking out. They need to be standing up. They never should have put through this war vote. I mean, that's the thing in my mind, and nobody in the press will say it. It's like the unspeakable truth. That was that war vote. That is why everybody's saying that they're upset with Congress. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
This quiet kingdom she is now. Forever will she be. In silence celebration. We're coming out.
34 minutes past the hour. Ruth in Phoenix, Arizona. Welcome to the program, Ruth.
Well, thank you, Tom. I'd like to respond to the woman that had called earlier when Bernie Sanders was on. It seemed so overwhelmed and kind of desperate with what we know today. And it's a quote from Mother Teresa, and it's called, "There is a light in this world more powerful than any darkness we may encounter. We sometimes lose sight of this force when there is suffering, too much pain. Then suddenly the spirit will emerge through the lives of ordinary people who hear a call and answer in extraordinary ways." And I think that pretty much sums up American people. We have always had that spirit within us. And I think that will bring us through this.
Yep, I think you're right. Ruth, thank you very much for sharing that with us. That's it's brilliant. It's interesting. Last night, Dr. Louis Melmadrona, who was on our program yesterday and has been our house guest for 2 days, just flew out this morning. He gave a speech here in Portland and afterwards came back to the house and we were sitting around talking and you know, about how change happens. And the conversation caused me to remember when I was 5 years old, 6 years old, 7 years old, little kid, on Sunday morning, waiting for the cartoons to come on. You know, sit and watch the test pattern on the screen for a while, and then there was this short little 15-minute religious program that came on, and then the cartoons would come on. And the short little religious program opened. I still remember this, and this was 50 years ago. It opened with a picture of a hand lighting a candle. And in the background, there was this song that would just, there were these words. And what they sang was, if everyone lit just one little candle, and you see this hand lighting the candle, and then you see thousands, millions of candles as the picture kind of changes. It says, if everyone lit just one little candle, what a bright world this would be. And it occurred to me that somehow that really got implanted, in my brain, that my job is to light my little candle. And if each one of us does that, then we really can enlighten the world. And pun intended. And I think, in Christianity, that's what Jesus was talking about when he said, don't put a bushel basket over your candle. It's, get out there and get active. It's just absolute wonderful bottom line idea. Bonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bonnie, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Tom, to tie in your comment that the Dems are looking for another way to do economics, I hope that's true. Because if we, the people, through our elected reps, pass tough CAFE standards, can't the transnationals use NAFTA to say that America caused them to lose profits and sue the government?
Conceivably, but, I'm not sure that that's so much the threat. But in terms of the Democrats trying to go beyond Clintonomics, this piece from today's Financial Times, they say, for example, Mr. Clinton, they talk about Bill Clinton, that he opened up foreign markets through NAFTA and the Uruguay round and all this stuff. And he says, now even the economic architect of the Clinton years, Robert Rubin and Lawrence Summers, who were successive Treasury secretaries, questioned much of the 1990s agenda. Summers said this week, the notion that the government is too large is absurd. We all talk about the central importance of education, but if paint is chipping off classroom walls, how are people supposed to believe we mean it? And then they go on to say, among the presidential candidates, even Mrs. Clinton, who has the most centrist platform, is arguing strongly for a more redistributive fiscal policy. What is striking is the extent to which they are willing to embrace the broader notion that dealing with inequality will require a larger role for government. In a clear echo of the stance taken by John Edwards, whose campaign is based around the moral challenge of lifting 37 million Americans out of poverty, Mr. Rubin argues that for stronger collective bargaining rights for workers in a recent speech, Mr. Edwards said, quote, the union itself is the difference between working in poverty and working your way out of poverty. And then they go on to say, they wrap it up by saying, this week, Mrs. Clinton rejected the forthcoming trade deal with South Korea. quoting Hillary Clinton. It will hurt the U.S. car industry, increase our trade deficit, cost us middle-class jobs, and make America less competitive, she said. So here we have Hillary Clinton saying that she's turning her back on her husband's policies.
Yes.
Yeah.
I hope so, because I can't tolerate any more of that strangulation. But, you know, before I run out of time, I did call about a little over 2 weeks ago. A homeschool mom called and asked where she could get a history curriculum that included our labor, populist, progressive history.
Right.
I don't remember that. Well, I'm
yes.
a homeschool mom, too, and I found a great 10-volume set for kids between grades 5 and 8 covering prehistoric humans all the way to the present day, and it's called A History of Us by Joy Hakim, H-A-K-I-M as in Mary. And my son happened to have the 8th volume, and it's called The Age of Extremes, and it included information about the Wobblies, Homestead Strike, Mother Jones, Joe Hill, Margaret Sanger. And it's written in a lively narrative, and I highly recommend it.
That is great. A History of Us?
Yes, yes.
By
I'd
Joy Hakim.
To. I've never.
By Joy Hakim, A-H-A-K-U-M. I will have to look for that.
H-A-K-I-M.
I am. Okay,
yeah,
great.
I would love for her to be interviewed somewhere, because the narrative is fabulous. She keeps people interested. And then regarding John Edwards, I read a great article about how the media are out to get him by Jeff Cohen. Did you read that?
Yeah, I did, and they are out to get him, and he's not taking money from PACs, and he's not taking money from lobbyists, and which is why I've contributed money to him. In fact, I did it again yesterday, I just think he's a great guy and running a great campaign.
Yeah, I think the media are doing to him what they did to Howard Dean, and I think Jeff made that
they
point.
Are. Yeah,
well,
they
thank
are.
You, Tom. Have a great weekend, and keep
thanks.
The light shining.
You too, Bonnie. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. 1-866-303-2270, Rebecca in Edmond, Washington. Hey, Rebecca.
Good morning. I'm glad you spoke about the Constitution today. I represent over 20,000 people in Washington State, and I want to respond real quickly in 4 points to what Senator Sanders said. And here are my points. Number one, it won't make any difference how good our legislation is as long as Bush is in office and can veto it. Our legislators have drunk the Kool-Aid, and they need to think about that. Number two, moving forward on energy and saving jobs and these many issues, these are important, but the Constitution is not an issue, and that's what they don't seem to understand. It's the foundation for our democracy. It's the remedy for tyranny and so forth. Number three, the White House refuses to comply with subpoenas. The only way you can get them to comply is to indict or impeach. And if you go to afterdowningstreet.org, they have a long list of all the subpoenas that have not been responded to.
Yeah. And if you go to afterdowningstreet.org, you'll also find that I am one of the signatories, and I'm on the advisory board of two different organizations that are calling for the impeachment of George Bush. Bernie and I disagree on this topic. We respectfully disagree.
Right.
I'm not going to, you know, he and I have had it out on the topic on the air at least twice, and we're just not going to revisit it every week.
But I just want to tell everybody, if you don't mind, if they would go to WashingtonForImpeachment.org, they would read all about our June 24th forum with Elizabeth De La Vega, David Lindorf, Phil Burke. Is he from Portland, by the way?
I don't know.
We don't know. But anyway, I appreciate your time and all you're doing to help save the Constitution.
Thank you, Rebecca, thank you for your passion and the work that you're doing. I mean, there are always going to be areas where we're all, you know, where we're going to disagree with each other on various things. I mean, that's one of the few areas where Bernie and I have a disagreement, and he knows more about the inside of politics, you know, how the sausage is made in the sausage factory than I do, but I still hold the opinion that I do. So anyhow. Della in Manhattan. Hey, Della.
Hello. Hello, Tom. You know, you said before that Hillary is distancing herself from Bill, but, you know, she sat on the board of directors of Walmart during the time that Bill Clinton
20
was governor.
20 years ago, 25 years ago.
She did nothing at all to help the people at Walmart to get labor rights, to get health care rights. She did nothing at all to promote their rights. So I don't really believe that she is distancing herself from Bill. I believe it's just a ploy to get her elected. Another thing is this, about the expropriation of our industry. our industrial base. It was Lenin who said a capitalist would sell rope to his own hangman, and that is what we are doing with expropriation of our industrial base. He was exactly right. And another thing is this. Reagan, you keep going from Reagan to Bush and saying, well, look at what they have done. They've destroyed our economic base. They've destroyed, they have war on the American working people. This is a form of terrorism. It's another form of terrorism against the American working man. We fear our jobs are going to be lost. But Clinton planted the foundation for this. He planted the foundation. It was he.
By pushing through NAFTA and the World Trade Organization.
NAFTA,
yeah, but let's remember, Della. First of all, I agree with you, and I criticized Bill Clinton and have for a long, long time on that topic. Let's also remember that it was a Republican Congress that pushed it through. Let's also remember that George Herbert Walker Bush was in support of it. Ross Perot was the guy who was right on that issue in that election back in the day. But this also started with Reagan pushing that agenda, and here we are. We've got to roll it back. We've got to change it. And I'm just pleased to see that Hillary's backing away from it. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Anything goes.
It's Anything Goes Friday. Fred 42 over in our chat room, in our live chat room. You can get to by going to airamerica.com and clicking on the Tom Hartman Show, and there's a link there to our chat room or from tomhartman.com. Says, I'm not a Hillary fan, but let's remember that when Hillary was on the Walmart board, Sam Walton was alive and in control and still buying American. In fact, the theme of Walmart was Made in America. And so, well, that's interesting. That's an interesting take on it. Also, it was the largest employer in the state of Arkansas where her husband was running to be the governor. So you can, I think it's possible to cut Hillary some slack on that. The Walmart of Sam Walton is a very different company than it is today. And I say that as you know, not as somebody who, you know, Hillary's not my first choice for president. Although if she's the nominee, I will support her. Victoria Jones on the line with us from Talk Radio News, talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, Tom.
How are you today?
I'm very well indeed. Fighting.
I am so looking forward to seeing you on Monday and Tuesday next week.
Me too.
You're going to be down at the Radio Row. We'll have a chance to say hi. And
I'll be down there at 6 o'clock in the morning. Yeah.
Oh, great.
I can hardly wait. Yes.
Yeah. Good.
Well, the Justice Department is very busy. On the one hand, you've got the Justice Department doing what many would see as a proper, right, sensible thing, and investigating Alberto Gonzalez because of the conversation that made Monica Goodling feel uncomfortable. This was the conversation where he reviewed everything to date and then sort of said, you know, how does that square with you? And she said that that made her feel very uncomfortable. They're investigating him for this. But then on the other hand, they testified before the House Judiciary Committee yesterday in connection with a new Journalist Shield bill, which, by the way, is being sponsored in part by a former conservative talk show host who's now a Republican representative, Mike Pence. So it's nice to see that Republicans sometimes do support the right things. And the Justice Department is saying that this Shield law will protect terrorists. And
you're kidding.
No,
it'll protect terrorists like what, you?
worse than me, actually.
I see. Mohammed Atta's the next version of Mohammed Atta is going to come over to the United States and get a job as a reporter for the Washington Post. Is that the deal?
The media wing of Mohammed Atta's outfit is going to be protected. Yes, that's what they're saying.
This is so absurd.
This is what's going on. Everything should scare us since 9/11. Anything that they feel is going to go against their agenda, they bring up 9/11, and they should scare us. And it is fascinating.
You said that the Republican Mike Pence is putting forward the Journalist Shield law. Where are the Democrats on this?
The Democrats are pretty livid. They're fully in support of the Shield law. The chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, John Conyers, called the Justice Department's claim totally absurd.
Ah.
So I think we can get a sense of where they are. Now, the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press is saying that they're not really concerned about Hamas or Hezbollah. She says they're concerned about Al Jazeera and other Arab newspapers and networks that have got news bureaus in the West. That's what she says they're concerned about.
But still, if they're a news agency, they're a news agency. I mean, there's a difference between being a news agency and being a guy who, you know, Tim McVeigh, being a guy who's going out to make a bomb.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, it's just quite extraordinary that they're going to try and stop this. Mike Pence, the Republican from Indiana, made the point, we face the real danger that there may never be another deep throat, he said. He also had William Safire there saying, the movement to force journalists to reveal their sources in an attempt to turn the press into an arm of the law.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, that's what they've been trying to do. That's what they've been doing. I mean, Judy Miller going to jail, as much as I despise the reporting that she did that led up to the war, you know, being a cheerleader for the war. And I think that to some extent her going to jail was a PR stunt on her part, you know, nonetheless. And later we learned that people that we thought were, you know, taking principled stands probably weren't, you know, like our friend from Meet the Press. Nonetheless, this is a really big issue.
I mean, it is a really big issue. They're also saying that it's too broad. They're once again using the argument, well, anybody can claim to be a journalist. And the argument back to that is, you know something? One lawyer said, the courts haven't had a whole lot of difficulty figuring out who's really engaged in something that looks and smells like journalism.
Well, they're concerned about bloggers, but even if anybody can claim to be a journalist, so what? I mean, if they're engaged in passing around information, you know, the only industry, the only business of the, you know, the Constitution defines a whole bunch of functions of government, and then it names only one industry for specific protection. And it was not the defense industry. It was not the agriculture industry. And you could argue that without food, we'd all starve and we'd all be dead. It wasn't, you know, the water industry or power or cannonball making or any of those things. The only industry that is protected in the United States Constitution is the press in the First Amendment. That's it. That's the only one. And successive administrations going all the way back to Nixon have been trying to roll back the authority of the press, the ability of the press, and thank God that a few Republicans and the Democrats are working together to try and give the press some protections. What do you think the chances of passage are?
I think that this particular bill has a very good chance of passing. I don't know whether it's going to be signed by the president, but I think it has a very good chance of passing.
That's great. We have about a half a minute left. I know there's a lot of other things happening in New York. You want to give us a quick summary in Washington?
Yes. We're told by the generals that the surge is starting now.
Oh, now.
Now. Okay. Now is when the surge has started. All the troops are in place, so you might have thought the surge had started some time ago. You would have been wrong. The surge has now started.
I consider myself enlightened.
Yes.
Okay. Anything else?
Let's see, what else? Well, the immigration bill's back, the bill of nine lives, that is back once again. This is a mini success for the president. He's quite pleased about this. And, of course, Scooter Libby is going to jail, as we know.
Yeah, within 45 to 60 days, and the press is really pushing for a pardon. I've just been amazed at all the talking heads on this thing.
It is so interesting. It really is. And the president not buying it at this point.
A guy who outed a CIA agent whose actions probably led, actually not his directly, but who was part of a conspiracy of actions that probably led to the death of people around the world and certainly crippled our intelligence agencies.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America. To the Tom Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain. This is Air America Radio.
Yes, anything you eat, only in America. Only in America. where a couple like that be allowed to unite.
George W. Bush, a little plastered here.
God bless America?
God bless America, yes. This being election year, you know, they're wonderful people. Fantastic.
From a few years back, of course.
Do I know any stories about
it?
No, I don't.
One little one.
Very mundane people. But
well, give me one little story about Jamie.
Very boring. Very boring person. But a wonderful person, but very boring.
Any Mike Weiss stories?
Mike Weiss, very boring person. Hates to drink, doesn't like to smoke. All around kind of guy. Very athletic. Loves to run. Fine golfer.
And Kelly Weiss.
Kelly, very skinny fella. Marathon runner. Hates to drink. Only in America could a guy like him even find work.
And last, but not least, Nancy Weiss.
Nancy Weiss, very slim person. Loves to run marathons. Only in America would anybody call her mom.
Thank you.
Yes.
So, you know, why the audio of Bush drunk? Well, you know, last week when I was in Europe, in Croatia, Bush didn't show up for the last day of the G8 meeting. He said he was a little ill at the stomach. And the photos are out now of the night before George Bush drinking beer with Andrea Merkel. They're in the European press. And BBC News, for example, U.S. President George W. Bush suffered a stomach upset on Friday and missed morning sessions of the G8 talks. White House counselor Dan Bartlett said Mr. Bush woke up feeling under the weather, but he was rejoining other leaders, though still not feeling 100%. Mr. Bush met French President Nicolas Sarkozy in his hotel suite on Friday and was keen to keep his schedule. Last night, Mr. Bush, a teetotaler, was seen sipping beer, but his advisors insisted it was non-alcoholic. Yeah, right. Like, in Germany, you can get non-alcoholic beer. Come on. I lived in Germany for a year. If you ask for a non-alcoholic beer, they will take you out on the streets, tie you to a post, start putting wood around your feet and looking for something to light it with. I mean, it's, what, non-alcoholic beer? I mean, it's like insulting the national heritage. So anyhow, this two incidents that I'm pretty sure, you know, the other time when Bush, remember, choked on the pretzel and he had the gash in his face, which we had a guest on who was an alcohol counselor. He said this is the absolute characteristic wound of people who have blackouts, alcoholic blackouts, because when the head falls forward, that's the heaviest part of the head where it generally impacts the ground. And, you know, he got drunk and passed out. It was a particularly bad day. I don't remember exactly what was going on that day, but the day before had been a really bad news day for Bush. And he was all alone, remember, down in the White House watching TV for several hours and then, choked on a pretzel and passed out. The reason I bring this up is not to play, some kind of, whiny gotcha with George W. Bush, but to point out how weird it is, or how hypocritical it is, or how strange it is, that when Bill Clinton was caught having an affair with an intern, there was 2 years of endless speculation by talking heads that continues to this day, 6, 7, 8 years later, about whether or not he was a sex addict and whether or not he could keep his hands off other women and whether or not he was being true to his wife any longer and on and on and on. And yet here we have a substantial, I would say, body of evidence that George W. Bush, an admitted alcoholic, well, he won't use the word alcoholic, but an admitted person with a drinking problem, so substantial that it threatened his marriage, that it estranged him from his family, that it caused him to be arrested and convicted of a crime associated with drinking, that the guy who has the button, the nuclear button, is getting plastered. And I'm talking seriously plastered. And there's no discussion of it in the press. So if it's a Democratic president and he's getting a little on the side, apparently that's something that's entirely appropriate to talk about and speculate about and, ad nauseum. But it's a Republican president, and he may be so impaired that he could make decisions or judgments that could alter the fate of all life on Earth. Substance abuse is no small thing. And alcohol is not, it's a serious drug.
It just doesn't get discussed, except by the BBC and the German press, which shows the pictures of Bush drinking the beer with Andrea Merkel. In fact, the one photo I'm looking at here, he's drinking the last sip of the glass. He's chowing it down pretty fast the night before. He's so sick that he can't go to the meeting. I heard nothing about this in the press, in the American press. It's just fascinating how, you know, the European press, you know, concerned about such things. The American press, nah. Joe in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Joe, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Hey, you talked about this a little bit earlier. I feel strongly like I'm being kind of set up by the press to expect and accept a pardon of Scooter Libby.
I agree. And you know, the talking heads, you know, right across the board, they're putting all these right-wingers on, these right-wing extremists, and letting them have their say over and over and over again. And I have, you know, it's been so long since I've seen any serious progressives in most of the so-called mainstream, particularly the cable shows. I mean, it's just all right-wing all the time. Joe, I agree. And I think we are all being set up for it. And frankly, I think that, you know, many of them are actually lobbying Bush for it. Although, you know, it's hard to say, you know, which is the tail and which is the dog, you know, which is wagging which. But, yeah, I agree, and I think it's a real problem. Kate in Arcata, California. Hey, Kate, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'd like to propose that, excuse me, rather than using the words middle class so much, because they seem a little bit abstract to me, and I don't know if anybody really identifies themselves as being in that class. I mean, nobody really knows if they're in it or not, at least from my experience. I'd like to start using the words working class more often, because it's everyone in this country, from blue collar to white collar, professionals, academics, everybody's suffering, and everybody's affected, especially by rising healthcare prices, where everybody could be wiped out. I mean, so many people could be wiped out so quickly. And so I really feel like I'm framing the conversation around working class, which includes everybody who's working.
Yeah, here's your point is well taken, Kate, and here's the problem with doing that. There have been studies of Americans asking, do you consider yourself to be in the middle class? And people making as little as $15,000 a year and people making as much as $150,000, $175,000 a year will all describe themselves as being in the middle class. And there's a broad consensus that you are either dirt poor, or you are very, very wealthy, or you're in the middle class. There's basically these three classes. On the other hand, when you ask people if they're in the working class, most white-collar workers will say no, because they think that that's a description of people who are blue-collar workers. Most blue-collar workers will be ambivalent about the term, because it's a term that was used by the communists and the Marxists and the socialists for so many years. The biggest problem with using the word working class is that it doesn't define automatically in people's minds the other class, which is the investor class, because the phrase investor class never gets used in the United States. It just isn't used. I mean, occasionally the Wall Street Journal, when referring to their readers, will talk about the investor class, but it's the investor class talking to itself.
Right.
But you will not hear the term investor class in America. And so when you use the word working class, it becomes an abstraction or, you know, something that's out of there's not a context for it, a larger context. And then you would get people, I would argue, that probably people like William Maguire, you know, the guy who got $1.7 billion, saying, well, you know, I work and I was a CEO and so I, that's why I stay with middle class. And I think that, you know, from a framing point of view, it's probably a good thing to do. Kate, thanks a lot for the call. George in Denver. Hey, George, got to take a break in just a minute. What's up?
Hey, I love that analogy where Bush is drunk at the wheel and we're all stuck in the car with him.
Yeah, in the back seats. Yeah.
Hey, I talked to you a few weeks ago about Popular Mechanics, of them debunking 9/11.
Yeah, and then since then their debunking has been debunked, and
well, the chief
and
editor,
on it goes.
The chief editor to that story was Ben Chertoff.
Mm-hmm.
That's the cousin of Michael Chertoff, head of Homeland Security.
Oh man!
And did you know what Chertoff stands for in Russian?
I did once. I thought it was devil, isn't it?
Son of the devil.
Son of the devil, yeah. See, okay. George, thanks a lot. Frankly, I don't know how much of this stuff is urban legend and how much is real, but But I do agree with the fundamental premise, and that's where I think we need to keep focused, that there has not been a serious investigation of 9/11, and there needs to be one. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
And head over to the airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page,
and join our blog. It's actually called Louise Hartman's Blog. And start blogging. It could put you in the running for our daily giveaway at the end of today's show. Our producer, David Poole, in his own inimitable way, will pick the best comment of the day, in his opinion, his totally arbitrary opinion, from our airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page. A page, and it could be a serious fun comment, a funny one, whatever. And that person's going to receive an autographed copy of my newest book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. So blog with us over at airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page. Just go to airamerica.com, and yeah, you can find it. It's no problem. Or drop into our live chat room. We've been having a conversation in the chat room. A couple of folks pointed out to me that Bush's, what the beer he was drinking was, what, Bockler? The Dutch low-alcohol beer, the near beer. And, okay, great. And I submit to you that an alcoholic drinking a near beer and then going back to the privacy of his own hotel room and probably pulling out a bottle of Jim Beam or ordering a six-pack is, in my opinion, what happened. I'm just willing to say it right out loud. I believe he was so badly hung over the next morning or even still drunk that he was unable to participate. It just makes perfect sense. So, anyhow, enough of that. Oh, and on the 9/11 thing, David and Louise and I, in particular David, he just worked his butt off on this thing. This was, David, your mic is open. How long ago was this? 6 months ago or so?
Yeah, right about that area.
We put out a call to Popular Mechanics, to a number of the folks who are on the side of, you know, Bush did it or the CIA did it or whatever, you know, all the various 9/11 conspiracies.
Yeah.
And we were going to pull them all together and do a 1 or maybe even a 2 hour program and let them all just have it out with each other. Right. And that,
yep.
and you know, no bias, let everybody have their say, but have the debate and have it right out and open and right out in the public. And what happened, David, when we made that offer to all these groups?
Well, they'll all come on the program. They just won't come on and discuss it in an open forum with other people. They'll all come on and tell their side of the story by themselves, but they won't come on and debate each other, and they won't come on and take phone calls.
Yeah. And so, you know, under those circumstances, we just said, okay, you know, we're going to pass because I'm not an expert and I'm not going to have somebody on and debate them on this issue, you know, so unfortunately. So, but, you know, let me just toss that out as a challenge. You know, if there are groups who the problem is getting the defenders on as well. But bottom line, we couldn't find anybody who was willing to come on with somebody of, you know, of the other side. Jake in Arcata, California. Hey, Jake, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how's it going? I'd like to say some words about Duncan Hunter. But first, I have to respond to, you know, the so-called mainstream media and the lack of coverage about Bush's substance abuse issue.
Yeah.
I mean, the man obviously is still drinking. Look at his press conferences. He can't put together a coherent sentence half the time.
There have been a couple of them where I was pretty sure that I didn't think he was drunk. I thought he was medicated. And during the debates, you know, with a second of those three debates, I thought he was very quite clearly medicated, and my guess was that he was taking some sort of an antidepressant along with a stimulant like Ritalin. You know, he is probably diagnosable with ADHD, but who knows? Who knows?
Well, that's right, and of course we remember the incident where he was giving Angela Merkel the shoulder rub in public that she did not appreciate.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, we know about the tabloids and their story about Condoleezza Rice and George W. Bush having a long-term affair, but none of this ever makes the mainstream media, but anything that happened, any kind of allegation about Bill Clinton's sex life was fair game, but they can't talk about the fact that Bush is obviously drinking and possibly having an affair with Condoleezza Rice.
Right, and possibly on medication. No, it's amazing. During the Clinton administration, it would show up in the National Enquirer, and then it would be on the NBC Evening News the next day. And during the Bush administration, there's been no shortage of tabloid coverage. Some of it actually, in my opinion, fairly good. And I, a good friend of mine used to be a reporter for 6 or 7 years, was a reporter for the National Enquirer. And they actually do fact-check their stories, believe it or not. Some of the other tabloids don't. And some of them openly make up stories. You know, they're just almost like, the Onion kind of things. They're pastiches. But it's like the mainstream media. I don't get it. Is it that they're all part of the same power structure and, there's just like this wink, wink, nod, nod, old boy network among all these people who are making 6 and 7 and 8 figure salaries and incomes? Or is it that they are terrified of this mafia-like organization that is known as the Bush dynasty?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. And they do have these interlocking board of directors. I mean, just look at, like you say, NBC is owned by General Electric. How many billions of dollars is General Electric making off this illegal war in Iraq? You know, the interests obviously are to keep the Republicans in power for these major, corporations that run the media. But, to overlook the obvious, that Bush, obviously he's been convicted of a DUI before. He's admitted he's had this drinking problem. Hell, he's had the cocaine substance abuse issues. And they don't want to touch any of it. And, I think it may have something to do with the fact that this guy makes horrible decisions, the fact that he's drunk.
Yeah, I think you may well be right, Jake. And it's something that, frankly, I think that we should be concerned about and we should be talking about. Not in, hey, nah, nah, gotcha, or anything like that. But, I mean, these are legitimate questions. This guy's the so-called leader of the free world. He's the president of the United States. Isn't it a legitimate question? Anyway, I'm of the opinion that it is. 27 minutes past the hour. Back with your calls. It's Anything Goes Friday on the Tom Hartmann Radio Program.
Is the Tom Hartmann Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Let me say thank you to those who love money. Let me say thank you to those who still fight fair.
Out there. 34 minutes past the hour, and a question on our blog over at airamerica.com/TomHartmann page provokes the
what evil lurks in the hearts of men. The liberal shadow knows.
Yes, I have the answer to your question. Mujo, 1952, posts this message. I don't think I understand the difference, the definitions of liberals and conservatives that Tom uses. I'm open to accept the idea with further explanation because I like to think that people are basically good, but my experience says I may be naive. If we liberals think that everybody is basically good, then we would not want, nor indeed need, the government to regulate anything. If conservatives believe that everyone is basically bad, they would want government regulation of everything for their own protection. I'm wary of other people and their willingness to put the good of society ahead of their own selfish interests. It may be that I have trusted what is right will be done, at least eventually, for too long, but I cannot ascribe the quality of goodness as I understand it to be used in the definition to people as a whole. Okay, here's the difference between liberals and conservatives. As it was at the founding of this country, and in my opinion, as it is today, but clearly, as it was at the founding of this country. I mean, you can go back and you read the writings of the founders. The core and radical assumption of the Enlightenment that was different from the beliefs held for 5,000 years before that, or 6,000 years before that, was that people were fundamentally good. And this was first put forward by thinkers like John Locke and Jean-Jacques Rousseau and Thomas Jefferson. And see what you're missing, Joe, 1952. What you're missing in your question is the therefore part of my explanation. And therefore, the purpose of government, the principal purpose of government, is to help people achieve their maximum potential that flows out of that natural and intrinsic and inherent goodness in them. And so, government does things like helping people get educated. Helping people get a house, helping people, giving giving it to them. It's the old, if you give a man a fish, you feed him for a day. If you teach a man to fish, you feed him for a lifetime. It's the teaching a man to fish kind of thing. But the purpose of government is to help people achieve their highest potential. And that's why in the preamble to the Constitution of the United States, the words that define what it's all about, it says, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, something positive, right? Bringing us together, create community, establish justice. In other words, make it a place where everybody has an equal chance. Everyone has justice, a positive value. Ensure domestic tranquility. In other words, provide for the, make it possible that people can live. Promote the general welfare. Again, helping people achieve their maximum potential. And secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. The blessings. These are all positive statements of positive values. Do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. That's the entire preamble of the Constitution of the United States. It lists six things. They are all, we are creating a government to hold people up and help them achieve their maximum potential. Conservatives, on the other hand, because they believe that people are intrinsically evil, believe that the only function of government should be to restrain people, to withhold people from their evil behavior. And therefore, they believe that the principal purpose of government should be to have an army and to have a police department. Period. End of discussion. And they will tell you that. Everything else is in their mind, quote, big government, end quote. So then you say, well, what about regulation? I thought, you know, if conservatives believe that people are evil, then wouldn't they want a lot of regulation? Well, no, and here's why. Because corporations are not humans. A corporation, the corporate form, operates under a different set of rules than humans do. It's essentially sociopathic. It's amoral. There is no morality for a corporation other than profit. And so from the point of view of a liberal who believes that people are good, morally good, an institution that has no fundamental morality, a corporation, would be inferior to the people and therefore should be regulated and controlled because it doesn't have intrinsic morality. But from the point of view of a conservative who believes that people are fundamentally evil, morally bad, an institution that is morally neutral would be superior to human beings and therefore should not be regulated. And in fact, if the corporations were allowed to rule the world, it would be a better thing for the humans because the humans are inferior, morally inferior to the corporations. So that's the key to understanding the thing is the therefore. So, I hope I've answered your question, and I'm guessing if you've posted that to the blog that, you know, if you have that question, probably a lot of other people do. And I know I riff on this from time to time, but it's worth getting back to the explanation. Jeffrey in San Francisco, California. Hey, Jeffrey, what's up?
Hey, no, I am so glad at long last to finally hear. I'm new to your show. I'm usually not at home during this time of the day, but finally somebody to stand up and make the comment that, you know, the Republicans made a humongous noise because Bill Clinton had a good time with a consenting adult and a box of cigars and want to impeach the man, but we have a man who has lied to Congress, who's lied to the American people, who has been told by a judge that his whole wiretapping thing was against the law.
And against the Constitution.
You know, why is he still there? And why does the American media not do anything? I mean, they made such a big deal about Bill. Jack Kennedy had a revolving door at the White House.
It wasn't just Jack Kennedy. I mean, this it goes back a long way.
Absolutely.
You know, Franklin Roosevelt had a mistress. Eisenhoer. I'm forgetting her name. George Herbert Walker Bush had a 26-year affair. Apparently, is pretty good. Kitty Kelly documents it very thoroughly in her book about the Bushes. Probably the only president who wasn't getting a little on the side was Richard Nixon.
Yeah. I am not. Like,
But what can we do in order, you know, individual people, what can we do to make our voices heard about, you know, what, and to make the media listen, you know, to start, you know, making points that we want made, you know?
I think we need to be talking back to the media. MediaMatters.org and ThinkProgress.org, the Center for American Progress and David Brock's Media Matters are doing a really fabulous job of putting out how biased the so-called mainstream media is, how profoundly conservative it is. And I encourage you to check out those websites. Say that again.
Absolutely, I agree. I mean, the whole thing, you know, they say that, you know, the media, oh, the liberal media, boo hiss.
Yeah, no.
I've been getting stuff online from the media over in Germany, their newspaper, a couple of papers from Scotland and Europe, and I get profoundly different.
Oh, yeah. Read The Independent. I mean, there's a variety of newspapers in Europe that are really, really solid and reporting on America. And they're very concerned about America because we've got all these nuclear weapons and we've got all this economic power and all these other things. And, yeah, absolutely. So my point, what I was saying is keep up to date with MediaMatters.org and ThinkProgress.org and then use that information to talk back to the media. You know, ABC, CBS, NBC, MSNBC, CNBC, they all have contact us pages on their website. They all have their phone numbers published. It is not impossible to contact them. And I think that we should be talking to our members of Congress about the possibility of programming in the public good. Now, I'm not talking about a pure fairness doctrine where somebody decides, oh, we should have this or that in the programming. But the question of, you know, we collectively own our airwaves, and are they being used in an appropriate way? And not just the airwaves. I mean, it's the whole issue of media concentration and consolidation in even newspapers. I'm frankly of the opinion that media in any state should be owned by people who are principally members, residents of that state, although I realize that there's a million ways to get around that. But the Sherman Act needs to be reapplied, and it needs to be reapplied to the media as much as anything else, in my humble opinion. So, Ralph in Colorado Springs, Colorado, listening on KKZN. Hey, Ralph.
Hello?
What's up? Hey, Ralph.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I think the reason Bush doesn't really want to pardon Libby now is because if you look at the USA Patriot Act definition of domestic terrorism, Scooter committed domestic terrorism. And
by participating in a conspiracy to out a CIA agent, you mean?
No, not at all. Domestic terrorism has to occur in the U.S., has to appear to be intended to influence government policy by intimidation, and has to involve acts dangerous to human life. And I think when you destroy a CIA secret cover corporation, Brewster Jennings Associates,
yeah.
That there are a lot of people that got whacked.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt in my mind that there are a number of people around the world who were affiliated with Brewster Jennings who ended up dead days, you know, a day or two or 3 days after Bob Novak put that name in his column. I mean, that was the most despicable thing. And Scooter Libby is just the tip of the iceberg, and most of this seems to lead right back to...
You don't know the power of the dark side.
Excuse me. Right back to Dick Cheney. I mean, maybe to George Bush as well, and it's something that really should be, you know, brought up and pointed out and talked about, and it's not being. And in that context, I think it's you know, oh, Scooter, he lied. About what? You know, let's talk about the underlying crime here and the criminal conspiracy that it's a part of and who else was involved with it. You know, pardoning Scooter Libby would be a crime in and of itself. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
This is my dad's favorite song. He played the trumpet. Louis Armstrong is one of his favorite people, and Father's Day is coming up, and we played this song, in fact, at his funeral last July.
Clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And thanks so much to my producer, David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Chris Lopresto and Lauren Kirshner at Air America, to Ben at White Rose Society, to Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. We have, well, I don't want to say a winner because it's not really a contest. David has picked somebody to get a book. Let's put it that way. Our runner-up, first of all,
From the blogging over at airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page. The runner-up is, we should let immigrants into the country on the basis of their native cuisine. Bring on the Mexicans and the Chinese, but no more Brits. I don't think Victoria Jones would be all that happy about that. Here's our winner, and our winner is from is Tromper. Tromper is also in our chat room, so Tromper, since you're in the chat room, just I am David Poole, your postal address. We'll get the book out to you right away. And because David's in the chat room as well every day. And right there it says David Poole. And here's Tromper's post on our blog. He says, I firmly believe that we can overcome the problems engendered by NAFTA and the various other mistakes made over the past 25 years by countering with the brains and brawn of our noble American public's traditional work ethic. The gushing water for this resurgent economic fire hose will need to be piped in by government funding of curry and chopstick factories the size of Utah. If we corner those two critical markets, we will not only increase employment and create interesting scents, but also, one, we will increase our manual dexterity using two sticks as utensils, thus improving other skills like knitting and moving chess pieces with flair, increasing our competitiveness in those industries. Two, we will counter India and China's dominance in the information technology, and panda industries by improving our ability to bargain in trade meetings. And finally, we will eat tasty food more often. I'm concerned that neither major party has fielded a candidate who has considered these obvious solutions and hope that they will do so in the future. Congratulations, Tromper. We're going to send you a book. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary.
Hi, Tom. Two observations, if I may. As you have noted yesterday, we are led by a president and vice president in the right wing of the Republican Party. They don't believe in government. And as you've noted, and I've said it too, that you can't govern if you don't believe in government.
Yeah.
And secondly,
in fact, I think I borrowed that statement from you,
fundamental
Gary.
Fundamental thing here. Is that this is what I call killer greed. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt, 72 years ago, as you probably know, 1935 at the convention, he said this. He said, here's what's going on. We have earned the hatred of entrenched greed. That's why we can't.
And can you guys hear me via the Comrex? Okay, we're still on. Great. Robert in San Francisco. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I noticed you're talking about Reagan. I think people need to think a little behind the men behind the curtain. Prescott Bush chose Nixon to run for high political office, and then they went ahead and put Bush as vice president behind Reagan. And when Reagan took a bullet 2 months after he was inaugurated, there Bush was in the shadows to become president. Now, Hinckley's were close family friends of the Bushes. John Hinckley went to school with Neil Bush. Don't you think that's a little bit too close for comfort? And if you look at all the wars that have happened in the 20th century, you can see the pretext. Even the Persian Gulf War, Saddam Hussein was set up. They stole oil from Iraq through Kuwait and provoked the attack, gave him a green light.
Yeah, April Gillespie saying, you know, don't worry, and we won't stop you. Now, Robert, your points are well taken, and the association between the Hinckley family and the Bush family is just about as creepy as the fact that the morning of 9/11, Bush Sr. was having breakfast with the brother of Osama bin Laden. I mean, you know, it's like at a certain point you look at all this stuff and you go, okay, I know coincidence happens, but man. There's, you know, anyway, Alan in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Alan.
Howdy. I kind of wish I'd have had a chance to float this past Bernie because I'd have been interested in his take on it, but we've all got an opinion. I've got an idea about doing something other than impeachment that I hope is kind of creative.
Mm-hmm.
And that is to wait until we get a new president, assuming that we actually get elections and not martial law, and that the first thing they do is to become a signatory to the International War Crimes Treaty.
Yes.
And then just ship all the people that we have to deal with over to The Hague and let them deal with them.
Well, yeah, we don't need, at that point, we wouldn't need to ship them. The international community would get together and say, okay, we'll take this one and that one and this one, because, you know, like they did in Germany, like they did with Slobodan Milosevic. There's no doubt in my mind that, in particular, Don Rumsfeld and arguably George Bush have participated in war crimes. There's just, you know, at the very least, Don Rumsfeld. And good point. Paul in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Paul, just a few seconds before we've got to wrap up
the
show.
Hey, good day, sir. Your discussion before about the Constitution, the framers, and what government were for does seem to me, and I think you've discussed this in the past, that they could have had no inkling of the power of the corporation and that the government...
Actually, they did. And James Madison warned us against the power of a corporation, as did Thomas Jefferson. I got a bunch of emails from people asking, what was I reading earlier in the week when I was talking about the sacrifices of the people who signed the Declaration of Independence? That's in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? And you'll find all those references to their concern about corporate power there. Coming up Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, I'll be live in Washington, D.C., Monday and Tuesday from the Take Back America Conference, Radio Row, and our blog contest is going to continue. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Have a great weekend and a great Father's Day.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.